Good afternoon, and welcome to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls The Courier. It's Monday, February 15th, and I'm your reader, Bob Young. We're looking at another bitterly cold day today. It looks like it's going to be cloudy all day. We'll get down to a low tonight of minus 18 degrees, and we'll have winds out of the north between 10 and 20 miles per hour, which will make for possibly record-setting wind chill factors. We will see some gradual warming this week, and by Saturday, we'll have highs of 21 degrees, and Sunday at 31 degrees, and again, warmer the next week. So hang in there and dress warmly, and remember that frostbite can set in as little as 15 minutes on exposed skin. It's the President's Day holiday today. On these days, the Courier does not issue a print copy of the paper, so we will be reading from the online issue of the Courier this afternoon. We begin with the Nation and World page, and under the Digest column, Biden calls for tougher gun laws. Tallahassee, Florida. Sorrow reverberated across the country Sunday as Americans, including President Joe Biden, joined a Florida community in remembering the 17 lives lost 3 years ago in the Parkland school shooting massacre. Quote, in seconds, the lives of dozens of families and the life of an American community were changed forever, Biden said in a statement released Sunday. The president used the occasion to call on Congress to strengthen gun laws, including requiring background checks on all gun sales and banning assault weapons. Quote, we owe it to all those we've lost and to all those left behind to grieve, to make a change, Biden said. The time to act is now, unquote. A former student of Marjorie Stoneman Douglas opened fire on campus with an AR-15 rifle on Valentine's Day in 2018. When the gunfire ended, 14 students and 3 staff members were dead, and 17 others were wounded. The suspect, Nicholas Cruz, is awaiting trial. Wintry weather sweeps most of U.S. Dallas. Snow and ice blanketed large swaths of the U.S. on Sunday, prompting canceled flights, making driving perilous, and reaching into areas as far south as Texas's Gulf Coast, where snow and sleet were expected overnight. Quote, typically, we just don't have quite this much cold air in place that far south, said Mark Charnard, a meteorologist with the National Weather Service's Weather Prediction Center. Hundreds of thousands of people remained without power in the Pacific Northwest, after a winter storm blanketed region with ice and snow and made travel treacherous. The greater Portland, Oregon area was the hardest hit, with more than 200,000 people still without power Sunday. Authorities said it could be a day or more before electricity is fully restored, and forecasters warned of more hazardous weather through Monday. Briefly, COVID vaccine. Japan on Sunday approved its first COVID-19 vaccine and said it would start nationwide inoculations within days. But months behind the U.S. and many other countries, Japan's health ministry said it had approved the vaccine co-developed and supplied by Pfizer Incorporated. Myanmar. Sightings of armored personnel carriers in Myanmar's biggest city and an internet shutdown raised political tensions late Sunday, after vast numbers of people around the country flouted orders against demonstrations to protest the military's seizure of power. Hit and Run, the father of rapper Nicki Minaj, has died after being struck by a hit-and-run driver in New York, police said. Robert Mirage, 64, was walking along a road in Mineola on Long Island at 6:15 p.m. Friday when he was hit by a car that kept going, Nassau County police said. Mirage was taken to a hospital where he was pronounced dead on Saturday. Royals. The Duke and Duchess of Sussex are expecting their second child, their office confirmed on Sunday. A spokesperson for Prince Harry, 36, and Meghan, 39, said in a statement, quote, we can confirm that Archie is going to be a big brother. The Duke and Duchess of Sussex are overjoyed to be expecting their second child, unquote. Subway stabbings. Rigoberto Lopez, a 21-year-old Brooklyn man, was arrested in the fatal stabbings of 2 people on New York City subway trains, police said Sunday. Lopez was taken into custody late Saturday and formally arrested Sunday on charges of murder and attempted murder, police said. And in Spain, the pro-Union Socialist Party claimed a narrow win in regional elections in Catalonia late Sunday, but the bloc of parties supporting secession by Spain's northeastern corner widened their control of regional parliament. On impeachment, a heartbreaking verdict. More inquiries are likely. Bipartisan support grows for independent commission. Washington. After a heartbreaking verdict, House prosecutors who argued for Donald Trump's conviction of inciting the U.S. Capitol riot said Sunday they proved their case and railed against the Senate's Republican leader and most of his colleagues, quote, for trying to have it both ways, unquote, in acquitting the former president. A day after Trump won his second Senate impeachment trial in 2 years, bipartisan support appeared to be growing for an independent September 11-style commission to make sure that such a horrific assault could never happen again. The end of the quick trial hardly put to rest the debate about Trump's culpability for the January 6th insurrections as the political leader and emotional fallout unfolded. More investigations into the riot were already planned, with Senate hearings scheduled later this month in the Senate Rules Committee. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Democrat of California, also has asked retired Army Lieutenant General Russell Honore to lead an immediate review of the Capitol's security process. Lawmakers from both parties signaled on Sunday that even more inquiries were likely. Quote, there should be a complete investigation about what happened, said Louisiana Senator Bill Cassidy, one of seven Republicans who voted to convict Trump. Quote, what was known, who knew it, and when they knew it, all that, because that builds a basis so this never happens again, unquote. Cassidy said he was attempting to hold President Trump accountable and added that as Americans hear all the facts, quote, more folks will move to where I was, unquote. He was censured by his state's party after the vote, which was 57-43 to convict, but 10 votes short of the two-thirds required. A close Trump ally, GOP Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, said he looked forward to campaigning with Trump in the 2022 election, when Republicans hoped to regain the congressional majority. But Graham acknowledged that Trump had some culpability for the siege at the Capitol that killed 5 people, including a police officer, and disrupted lawmakers' certification of Democrat Joe Biden's White House victory. Quote, his behavior after the election was over the top, Graham said. Quote, we need a 9/11 commission to find out what happened and make sure it never happens again, unquote. The Senate acquitted Trump of a charge of incitement of insurrection after House prosecutors laid out a case that he was an inciter-in-chief who unleashed a mob by stoking months-long campaign of spreading debunked conspiracy theories and false, violent rhetoric that the 2020 election was stolen from him. Trump's lawyers countered that Trump's words were not intended to incite the violence and that impeachment was nothing but a witch hunt, unquote. The conviction tally was the most bipartisan in American history, but left Trump to declare victory and signal a political revival while a bitterly divided GOP bickered over its direction. The Republicans who joined Cassidy in voting to convict were Senators Richard Burr of North Carolina, Susan Collins of Maine, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, Mitt Romney of Utah, Ben Sasse of Nebraska, and Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania. Next on this page, we see a nighttime photograph of people standing in the snow and drawing heart shapes using the lights on their cell phones. And the caption on the photograph says, people draw hearts with their cell phone flashlights in support of jailed opposition leader Alexei Navalny and his wife, Yulia Navalnaya, on Sunday in Moscow. When Navalny's team announced a protest in a new format, urging people to come out to their residential courtyards on Sunday and shine their cell phone flashlights, many responded with skepticism, but Russian authorities moved vigorously to extinguish the illuminated protests. Obamacare sign-ups reopen, Congress pushes for financial help to lower insurance premiums, filed by the Associated Press. Washington. Healthcare.gov's market for subsidized healthcare plans reopens Monday for a special 3-month sign-up window as a Democratic-led Congress pushes a boost in financial help that could cut premiums by double digits. This enrollment period during the coronavirus pandemic is an early test of President Joe Biden's strategy to use the Affordable Care Act as a springboard toward health care coverage for all. Advancing on a parallel track, the new COVID-19 relief bill from House Democrats would offer a generous, though temporary, increase in subsidies for people covered by the law known as Obamacare. It's hugely important signaling move, said Catherine Hempstead of the nonpartisan Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Quote, the administration is doing more than having open enrollment here. They're saying that they want to make this coverage more affordable, unquote. While policy experts like Hempstead are taking note, it's unclear how uninsured Americans will respond. Former President Barack Obama's health care law has been on the books over a decade, but surveys consistently show that many people lacking job-based insurance do not realize they may qualify. The Congressional Budget Office estimates that about 33 million people are uninsured this year. At Foundation Communities, an Austin, Texas nonprofit that serves low-income working people, Program Director Corey Hatmer says she's seeing an uptick in interest. Although her agency had not started advertising, appointments for enrollment assistance booked up quickly. Volunteer counselors are being called back. For clients, it's their last chance probably to enroll in health insurance for 2021, Hatmer said. One is Jacqueline Barades, a housekeeper and restaurant worker unemployed since the start of the pandemic. Her husband hung on to his maintenance job, but the couple and their 2 children are uninsured. Barades said a friend told her about the health law, and she intends to follow through. With no health insurance as the pandemic stretches into its 2nd year, Barades is uneasy. Quote, we are not exempt from having something happen to us, she said in Spanish, her first language. Quote, not having the means to respond is extremely worrisome, unquote. The Biden administration is going the extra mile to try to sign up people such as Barades. Healthcare.gov will be accepting applications through May 15th, a period about twice as long as the annual open enrollment. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which runs the program, has a $50 million advertising budget, 5 times what the Trump administration would spend on annual open enrollment. Under Biden, there will be a special emphasis on reaching Black and Latino communities that have borne a heavy burden from COVID-19. Across the country, people in 36 states served by the federal healthcare.gov marketplace will be able to apply. Additionally, most states that run their own marketplaces are matching the federal effort, giving it the feel of a national campaign. The appeal for uninsured people could become much clearer if Congress increases premium subsidies as part of its next virus relief package. Average new U.S. coronavirus cases below 100,000. Atlanta. Average daily new coronavirus cases in the United States dipped below 100,000 in recent days for the first time in months, but experts cautioned Sunday that infections remain high and precautions to slow the pandemic must remain in place. The 7-day rolling average of new infections was well above 200,000 for much of December and went to roughly 250,000 in January, according to data kept by Johns Hopkins University, as the pandemic came roaring back after it had been tamed in some places over the summer. That average dropped below 100,000 on Friday for the first time since November 4th. It stayed below 100,000 on Saturday. Quote, we are still at about 100,000 cases a day. We are still around 1,500 to 3,500 deaths per day. The cases are more than 2.5 times what we saw over the summer, Dr. Rochelle Walensky, director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, said on NBC's Meet the Press. Quote, it's encouraging to see these trends coming down, but they're coming down from an extraordinarily high place. On Saturday, the 7-day rolling average for deaths was around 2,500. That number peaked at more than 3,300 earlier in the winter, according to Johns Hopkins. The U.S. saw a spike of more than 5,400 deaths reported Friday, nearly half from Ohio, where authorities said earlier in the week that they plan to add deaths to the state's tally over the course of a few days, after discovering as many as 4,000 unreported COVID-19 fatalities. Walensky added that new variants, including one first detected in the United Kingdom that appears to be more transmissible and has already been recorded in more than 30 states, will likely lead to more cases and more deaths. Quote, all of it really wraps up into we can't let our guard down, she said. Quote, we have to continue wearing masks. We have to continue with our current mitigation measures. And we have to continue getting vaccinated as soon as that vaccine is available to us. Unquote. The U.S. has recorded more than 27.5 million virus cases and more than 484,000 deaths, according to the Johns Hopkins data. Larry Sonner, a former minister, dies of COVID-19. Stories filed by Sarah K. LeBlanc and Courtney Crowder of the Des Moines Register. Reverend Dr. Larry Sonner waited about a week to turn himself in. The Methodist minister had married a lesbian couple the weekend before, on October 2014, going against the Protestant Church's doctrine. Other ministers had done so in the past, but they kept the unions quiet and the ceremony secret. Larry saw a problem with their silence. If Methodists wanted to call themselves inclusive, he asked, how could they deny LGBTQ people the right to marry in their faith? On one hand, disobeying church rules could lead to grave consequences. He could lose health benefits. He could lose his standing as a minister. He could lose his pension, putting his and his wife Sue's entire retirement at risk. But on the other hand, Larry wanted to start a conversation about fairness and equity. And despite being a lifelong introvert, Larry knew how and when to speak up. So he married the couple, after premarital counseling, of course, and turned himself into the church brass. Complaints were filed, meetings held, an internal church trial considered. With that one set of I do's, an unassuming grandfather vaulted into the headlines, making a personal risk in the name of what he thought was right. On November 27th, Larry became one of the almost 5,000 Iowans to die of COVID-19. The 84-year-old is among a growing group of clergy who have succumbed to the disease, including Father John A. Voliskas, famous for his carnival ministry, Reverend Gary A. Miller, who helmed the Grace Fellowship Church for nearly two decades, and countless laypeople and volunteers. Larry was not afraid to speak out on behalf of the least, the last, and the lost, regardless of the consequences. Lori Holler, bishop of the Iowa branch of the United Methodist Church, said in a statement, our hearts are filled with gratitude as we remember and celebrate the goodness of Larry's life and vow to carry on his legacy of grace, peace, and justice for all. A native of St. Joseph, Missouri, Larry didn't look far for the woman who would become his soulmate and lifetime companion. Sue, then a freshman at Central Methodist University, was his roommate's little sister. The pair married in 1959, the start of more than 61 years together. A born caregiver, Larry was the first director of the Office of Pastoral Care for the Iowa branch of the Methodist Church. For more than three decades, he counseled pastors and their families, guiding them through hope and heartbreak. At home, Larry was an expert at making sure his children knew he loved them. For Christmas, it didn't matter what gifts were under the tree. The most special present for Larry's daughter, Deb, was a letter from her dad placed among its branches, Deb said. Quote, it was just a tribute to you as a child, what a wonderful child you were, and how proud they were of us. And those things just mean the world to me to this day, she said. Every year on Super Bowl Sunday, Larry would act as a butler for his two sons, serving them any snack they wanted and pouring them an unlimited supply of soda. Deb got her own day, which always centered on her favorite movie, The Sound of Music. Born just after the Great Depression, Larry's family didn't take many vacations. His dad could earn extra money if he worked instead of taking his allotted 2 weeks of paid time off, so they stayed put during school breaks. When Sue and Larry married, they did their best to show their children the whole country. Quote, every single year of our life we traveled, Deb said. Every August, when Larry had the month off, the family would pile into a car with a camper trailer and set off on trips, road tripping to the Pacific Northwest, the Northeast, and to Disney World every other year. Under the tent flaps of their camper, they would play cards, watch the stars, and talk about life, death, and everything in between. When the family returned, they'd make collages with items from their trips. Then, with all the photos Larry had taken on the trip, the family would grab popcorn and sit down for a slideshow of their vacation. Quote, that was one of my favorite things growing up, when my dad would get the slide projector out, Deb said. When his children had children of their own, no matter where they lived, Larry made sure to be part of their lives. For Deb, that meant visiting her, her husband, and their four children in Houston for at least 3 weeks almost every February, and in December for her children's choir's madrigal dinner. When he wasn't traveling or spending time with his grandchildren, Larry enjoyed learning about finance. From a young age, he taught his children the power of compounding interest, Deb said. Those lessons had a deeper meaning. Quote, he would always talk with us about how you spend your money really represents your values, she said. Larry was organized and methodical, the type of man who would write a chore on a list just to cross it off, Deb said. He was the type of man who was his daughter's whole world, she added. Quote, he had his partner for over 60 years. He had three successful children. He had grandchildren with whom he had a personal relationship with each one of them. He's gotten to travel. He was successful in his career, and he pursued his academic goals. He just did it right, Deb said. As to the conversation that Larry started with those I do's, the United Methodist Church remains divided on same-sex unions, though the issue is poised to take over the church's next general conference. Larry never had a trial, despite the charges against him. Instead, leadership scrapped the proceedings for a written resolution that the Iowa branch of the United Methodist Church would keep discussing what the church's policy of inclusion and grace for all really means. Quote, I'm very happy with the discussions we had and the result we came to, unquote, Larry told the Register when the resolution was reached in 2015. I am especially proud of our church for pledging to continue to talk about LGBTQ issues, including marriage and the clergy, unquote. Quote, that's the very best I could hope for, unquote. This is an editorial which first appeared in the Des Moines Register. GOP thrives on attacking trans people like me. I just can't even with this legislature anymore. It's only been a month, but its fundamental awfulness continues unabated. One would think that with the COVID emergency now entering its second year, that our government would be deploying an all-hands-on-deck approach to helping COVID go the way of polio. But this is clearly not a priority for our government. You know what is, though? Trying to make sure every transgender Iowan understands how much their government does not like them and disapproves of their entire existence. And surely Iowa is not the only state where these atrocious bills are being introduced, but they are being introduced at an exceptionally alarming rate, as if our existence is a larger threat than a plague that has killed more than 5,000 Iowans in a single year. To be sure, these bills thrive off misinformation to exist. More Americans claim to have seen a ghost than know a transgender person. So in an effort to change that, hi, I'm Amy Wichtendahl, and I'm transgender. Hopefully, now you can say you know at least one person. The first thing to know about trans people is that, no, it is not a phase. This is not something you can outgrow. I was assigned male at birth, and I knew that I am female at the age of 9. 15 years of trying to deny this didn't work, and I began my transition at 25. It's 16 years later, and I have no regrets. Transitioning saved my life. If I had had the ability to transition as a teenager, you better believe I would have. But now young trans kids have the option to get health care that they need and transition to become the people they've always known they are, saving them untold amounts of pain, depression, and heartache. And yet, our legislature wants to stop it. As a thought experiment, women, I want you to imagine your own teenage years. Imagine growing facial hair and thick body hair. Men, same thing. I want you to imagine what it would be like to menstruate and have your first period. That's what these bills intend to do to trans kids throughout Iowa. Take personal medical decisions away from families and doctors and put them in the hands of politicians. We also have a bill to stop trans girls from playing sports. Why? There is no great undoing of women's sports. As many other articles have pointed out, the International Olympic Committee has allowed participation of trans women for 20 years in Olympic sports, and not one has won a gold medal. You're trying to fix a problem that doesn't exist and hurting people along the way. And while we're still on the topic, Iowa legislators, what is the deal with you in bathrooms? I don't know why Representative Skylar Wheeler wants me to use the bathroom with him, and I don't want to know, but it's weird. Then there's the effort to strip gender identity out of the Iowa Civil Rights Act altogether. Let me be clear. If any legislator can behold the Iowa flag with the words, "Our liberties we prize and our rights we will maintain," and still file a bill to strip their fellow citizens of their natural civil rights, they have no business serving in the people's house. Now, it is possible that none of these bills will pass into law. Certainly, they're grossly unconstitutional and would likely never see the light of day. So why do I worry about it? Because these laws would have unintended side effects, from continuing discrimination against transgender people to reinforcing stereotypes to perpetuating self-harm and suicide among the transgender community. If I can help stop these things by speaking out, I absolutely will. But also, as Iowans, you should demand better of your legislators, and especially of the Republican Party. There is a time in my life where I identified as a Republican. I left because every time the GOP would talk about how much they believed in freedom, there would also be an asterisk next to it. That there were always certain groups of people that did not deserve freedom, whether it be black people, immigrants, gay people, women, trans people, etc. Followed to its logical conclusion, it means the party believes only a few people are truly deserving of freedom and equality in this American life. That ideal is a central tenet of authoritarianism. But authoritarianism does not have answers to the people facing our state or our nation. It offers only scapegoats. It hopes that you won't notice that they're not doing anything to make your life better, but hope you will join in making other people's lives worse. If you want a government that focuses on putting you and your family first, if you want a government that is committed to fighting COVID and improving health care, if you want to rebuild rural Iowa with something more than CAFOs, then you want businesses to set up shop and create jobs, we have to stop electing people who file bills like this. It means pushing back when your legislature wastes time, and it means removing the burden of governing from the Republican Party in 2022. Instead, electing people who stand for freedom, not fear. Amy Wichendahl, a lifelong Iowan, is a Hiawatha City Councilwoman, thought to be the first openly trans woman elected to government in Iowa. You are listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls The Courier for Monday, February 15th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to the sports page. In Sunday's hockey games, Penguins pull away from Capitals, filed by the Associated Press. Pittsburgh. The Pittsburgh Penguins have stayed afloat by showing a remarkable ability to rally late. Forced to protect a rare third-period lead, they didn't let the opportunity go to waste. Tristan Jarry made a series of big stops late and a pair of empty net goals by Zach Ashton-Reese and Sidney Crosby helped the Penguins pull away for a 6-3 victory over the somewhat rusty Washington Capitals on Sunday. Pittsburgh entered the game having been either tied or trailing going into the third period in each of their first 12 contests. Nursing a one-goal advantage this time around, the Penguins held their ground to stay unbeaten at PPG Paints Arena at 5-0, with three of those wins coming against the rival Capitals. Quote, "There was a lot to like," Pittsburgh head coach Mike Sullivan said. "We competed hard." Brian Rust scored twice, including a second period power play goal that ended a 0-for-20 stretch with the man advantage and added an assist. Brandon Tenev and Jake Guentzel also scored for Pittsburgh, which has won two straight. Jerry made 28 saves and assisted on Aston Reese's empty netter with 1:03 to go that finally put Washington away. It's been a bumpy start for Jerry, an all-star a season ago who had found himself sitting for long stretches thanks to the steady play of backup Casey DeSmith. DeSmith, however, was unavailable due to a non-COVID-19 related illness. Jari made sure emergency call-up Maxim Legas wasn't necessary. Quote, "Hopefully Tristan should gain some confidence off of this," Sullivan said. "He certainly should. It's a solid performance by him," unquote. Golden Knights 1, Avalanche 0. Max Pacioretty scored early in the second period. Marc-Andre Fleury made 30 saves and host Vegas beat Colorado. Vegas, which improved to 5-1-0 since returning from a pause due to COVID-19 protocols, leapfrogged the St. Louis Blues to reclaim first place in the West Division. The Golden Knights are 1 point ahead of St. Louis with 21. Vegas was playing on the second of back-to-back days after a 3-1 win at San Jose on Saturday. Colorado played for the first time in nearly 2 weeks after its schedule was paused due to coronavirus protocols. Fleury, who has allowed 2 or fewer goals in 7 of his 8 starts this season, improved to a 12-5-2 lifetime against the Avalanche. Around the league, NHL adapts its COVID approach. New York. Buffalo Sabres coach Ralph Kruger marked his return to practice Sunday with an upbeat but cautionary message following a 10-day bout with what he called moderately severe symptoms of COVID-19. Quote, "Definitely a time to realize how lethal this COVID is," the 61-year-old Kruger said, while expressing relief his wife hasn't been infected. "I'm feeling quite well, but of course scarred by the experience," unquote. The first month of the NHL's pandemic-shortened season has been a bumpy one. The Sabres are among 8 teams that paused their seasons, and 35 games have been postponed. From January 13th through Saturday, 120 players from 26 of 31 teams have spent at least 1 day on the COVID-19 list. Some tested positive, others were identified as close contacts, and a few had to quarantine after traveling from another country. Buffalo is set to return from a 15-day break by hosting the New York Islanders on Monday. The Colorado Avalanche resumed play at Vegas on Sunday. Minnesota and New Jersey are scheduled to return Tuesday, while the Philadelphia Flyers, who currently have 7 players on the NHL COVID-19 list, are on pause until at least Thursday. The NHL completed last season's playoffs in tightly secured bubbles in Toronto and Edmonton, Alberta. Without those, outbreaks were considered inevitable. Briefly, Blues, Coyotes, St. Louis, and Arizona wrap a 7-game regular season series Monday in Glendale, Arizona. The series is the longest in regular season in NHL history. Flames. Defense man Connor McKay made his NHL debut Saturday. The 24-year-old signed with Calgary last March after playing 3 seasons at Minnesota State University, Mankato. Sunday's games in the NBA. Surging Spurs top Hornets remain unbeaten versus East. Associated Press. Charlotte, North Carolina. Dejounte Murray had 26 points and 12 rebounds, and the San Antonio Spurs outlasted the shorthanded Charlotte Hornets for a 122-110 victory Sunday night. Derek White scored 12 of his season-high 25 points in the fourth quarter, helping San Antonio to his 5th win in 6 games. The Spurs also improved to 5-0 against Eastern Conference teams. Larry Rozier had 33 points for the Hornets, who played without leading scorer Gordon Hayward, who had a sore back. Nuggets 122, Lakers 105. Nikola Jokic recorded his sixth triple-double of the season with 23 points, 16 rebounds, and 10 assists, and host Denver beat Los Angeles, snapping the Lakers' seven-game winning streak. Thunder 114, Bucks 109. Justin Jackson scored a season-high 22 points and hit a three-pointer in the final minute to help host Oklahoma City overcome Giannis Antetokounmpo's triple-double and beat Milwaukee. The Thunder won without leading scorer Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, who sat out with a sprained left knee. Antetokounmpo had 24 points, 17 rebounds, and 10 assists for the Bucks, who have lost three straight. Suns 109, Magic 90. Devin Booker scored 27 points, and host Phoenix held Orlando to 35 points in the first half, en route to a sixth straight win. Grizzlies 124, Kings 110. Jonas Valanciunas scored a season-high 25 points and had 12 rebounds to offset a late technical foul, and Memphis beat host Sacramento. Clippers 128, Cavaliers 111. Lou Williams scored a season-high 30 points in his first start of the season, and host Los Angeles sent Cleveland to its seventh straight loss. Pistons 123, Pelicans 112. Mason Plumlee had 17 points, 10 rebounds, and 10 assists for his first career triple-double as host Detroit beat New Orleans. Trail Blazers 121, Mavericks 118. Damian Lillard scored 34 points and had 11 assists, and Luka Doncic, 44 points, missed a potential tying three-pointer in the closing seconds as Portland edged host Dallas. Timberwolves 116, Raptors 112. Karl Anthony Towns scored 7 of his 20 points late in the fourth quarter before fouling out as Minnesota snapped a four-game losing streak with a win over Toronto and Tampa, Florida. Wizards 104, Celtics 91. Bradley Beal returned from a rare night off for a breather to produce 35 points. Russell Westbrook finished just a rebound shy of a triple-double as host Washington beat Boston. Around the NBA, Lakers Davis hurt, forced to hobble off Denver. Los Angeles Lakers forward Anthony Davis gingerly made his way to the locker room after appearing to aggravate a sore right Achilles late in the first half against Denver on Sunday night. Davis was fouled by Nuggets big man Nikola Jokic as he drove to the basket. Davis hobbled to the free throw line, made both shots, and then was subbed out with 2 minutes 39 remaining. He immediately headed toward the locker room. Entering the game, Davis was questionable with what was described as right Achilles tendonitis. Davis missed two contests due to the ailment before returning in a win over Memphis on Friday. Nets Durant out at least two games. Brooklyn. The Nets won't have Kevin Durant for at least the next two games of their West Coast road trip. He has a mild hamstring strain, according to the team, and will sit out both ends of their back-to-back on Monday and Tuesday against the Sacramento Kings and Phoenix Suns. Durant had 20 points in 33 minutes against his former team as the Nets blew out the Warriors on Saturday night. Leonard out. Kawhi Leonard, lower leg contusion, didn't play for the Los Angeles Clippers against the Cleveland Cavaliers on Sunday night, joining injured teammate Paul George on the sideline. Coach Tyronn Lue had no update on George. He missed his fifth straight game because of a right foot injury. Briefly, Wizards. Washington guard Ish Smith was out with a strained right quadriceps on Sunday. He'll also miss Monday's game, Coach Scott Brooks said. In the NASCAR recap, Daytona, McDowell claims wet, wild 500. And the story opens with a nighttime photograph of a fiery crash scene that has at least 7 cars involved in this field of view. And the caption says, "Racers crashed during the last lap in Daytona 500 early Monday at Daytona International Speedway in Daytona Beach. Michael McDowell made it through the crash and won the race, with his only lead lap being the last lap. This story is filed by Jenna Fryer of the Associated Press, Daytona Beach, Florida. Somebody had to make a move to win the Daytona 500, and maybe Michael McDowell would have pulled out of traffic to take his shot at a monster upset. McDowell never had to play his hand. He stayed right where he was, flat in the gas, and drove through a crash scene at Daytona International Speedway with a fiery multi-car pileup in his rearview mirror. The journeyman pulled off a stunning upset early Monday morning. A 100-to-1 underdog when the race began Sunday afternoon, McDowell won for the first time in 358 Cup starts when the checkered flag finally flew about 15 minutes after midnight. The race was stopped by rain for almost 6 hours and ended 9 hours after the green flag waved at Daytona International Speedway. Quote, "So many years just grinding it out and hoping for an opportunity like this," McDowell said. Quote, "Such a great way to get a first victory, a Daytona 500. Are you kidding me?" Unquote. NASCAR's season opener was stacked with storylines. Denny Hamlin was trying for a record third consecutive Daytona 500 victory, and the team he started with, Michael Jordan, was debuting with driver Bubba Wallace. Kyle Larson was back after nearly a year in exile for using a racial slur, and reigning Cup champion Chase Elliott tried for his first Daytona 500 win. And all the way at the back of the field, 1990 Daytona 500 winner Derek Cope made what he said would be his final NASCAR start. At 62, he was the oldest driver in the field, and his upset victory 31 years ago was considered the biggest in race history. McDowell didn't challenge Cope for that distinction because McDowell is considered a talented super speedway racer who just needed to be in the right place to finally win. He watched and waited as he trailed Team Penske teammates Joey Logano and Brad Keselowski, and it was Keselowski who finally broke free from the parade of cars. Keselowski tried to pass Logano, but the teammates made contact, triggering a melee all over Daytona International Speedway. "I wanted to make the pass to win the Daytona 500, and it ended up really bad," Keselowski said. "I don't feel like I made a mistake, but I can't drive everybody else's car. So frustrating." Logano had no explanation for the ending. "Pandemonium, I guess. Chaos struck," he said. It was indeed mayhem once McDowell cleared the crash. The collisions were one on top of another, flames erupting all over the track as McDowell drag-raced Elliott and Austin Dillon until NASCAR finally called a caution. A batch of solid contenders were knocked from the race just 15 laps in by a 16-car accident that began at the front of the field. It thinned the pack and set up a showdown between Kevin Harvick and Hamlin. Hamlin and Harvick had the two best cars, but pit strategy ended Hamlin's shot at winning a record third consecutive Daytona 500. The Ford drivers pitted first as a group, followed by the Chevrolet's lap later, and finally the Toyota's. But the Toyota group has just five cars, and they couldn't group back together to reclaim control of the race. It put Logano, Keselowski, and the Ford drivers out front, and Logano led the final 25 laps until Keselowski made his move. Briefly, Earnhardt tribute. Fans and crews saluted the late Dale Earnhardt, the seven-time Cup Series champion, by holding up three fingers on lap three during the Daytona 500, recognizing the 20th anniversary of his death, which came on the final lap of NASCAR's signature event. Earnhardt drove the famed number three for Richard Childress Racing. Wallace. Bubba Wallace ran into trouble early and late in his first Daytona 500, driving for Michael Jordan. He still came out of NASCAR's marquee race with another milestone, becoming the first black driver to lead a lap in the Daytona 500, grabbing the lead on lap 129. This is an article from the February 13th edition of The Economist in the Asia section. The Tokyo Olympics, Olympic glory. The red digits on the clock outside Tokyo Station tick off the seconds until the Olympic Games begin on July 23rd. Yet the closer the date gets, the greater the uncertainty about whether the Games will go ahead at all. The clock has, after all, already been reset once. As the COVID-19 pandemic spread across the world last year, they were delayed until this year. Organizers spoke of the Olympics as a symbol of the light at the end of the COVID's tunnel. With the torch relay, the official start of the festivities, set to begin on March 25th, but with the disease still rampant, another decision looms. It is a more complicated choice than it was last year. COVID-19 is better understood and more efficiently controlled than before, making the games, at least without masked spectators, appear tantalizingly feasible. But holding them comes with a big risk. An Olympic outbreak would symbolize hubris and incompetence and could provoke a crisis for the Prime Minister, Suga Yoshihide, whose approval ratings are already sagging. The alternative is also unpalatable. The International Olympic Committee, IOC, has, at least so far, ruled out another postponement, meaning that if the Tokyo Games are not held this year, they will probably be canceled altogether. Quote, they have presented the Games as a symbol of victory over the coronavirus, so if they cancel, it becomes a symbol of the Japanese government's failure, says Sone Yanusori of Keio University. Quote, both options are quite terrible, unquote. The reasons to cancel the Games are obvious. The pandemic is still raging around the world, with nearly 300,000 new cases recorded every day. Japan itself is in the midst of a stubborn third wave that forced the government to extend a state of emergency until early March. Although vaccination campaigns have begun in many countries, even the most optimistic estimates do not foresee immunity becoming widespread enough by the summer to guarantee a virus-free event. In Japan, the first jabs have yet to be administered. Some public health experts say it would be mad to go ahead. Even some athletes agree. As Niya Hitomi, a Japanese track and field star, put it, quote, to be honest, I think life is more important than the Olympics, unquote. The Japanese public, predictably, has soured on the idea of hosting tens of thousands of athletes, journalists, and other hangers-on from around the world, each potentially a vector for the virus. When polled in 2019, nearly 90% of Japanese were looking forward to the Olympics. Recent polls show that 80% now oppose holding games this year, roughly 40% favor cancellation, and another 40% want another postponement. Spiraling costs have added to the misgivings. The tab had already ballooned from a projected $7.3 billion to an official estimate of $12.6 billion, but government's own auditors put the true cost at over $20 billion. Postponement and virus protection measures will add another $2.8 billion to the total. The president of Tokyo's organizing committee, Mori Yoshiro, an 83-year-old former prime minister, added to the event's problems earlier this month when he suggested that women talk too much in meetings, prompting a storm of public indignation. Japanese media are reporting that he will soon resign. Yet, though the Japanese people bear most of the risks of the games, the choice is not theirs alone. Japan's top leadership remains committed. Mr. Suga told a recent virtual gathering of the World Economic Forum that Japan is, quote, determined to deliver hope and courage to the world, unquote. So is the IOC. Thomas Bach, its president, said there is no plan B to hold the Olympics in Tokyo this year. Myriad stakeholders, from national Olympic committees to corporate sponsors to television networks, have an interest in seeing the games happen, even in a limited forum. Many athletes would welcome the chance to compete. Many Japanese business leaders believe even a circumscribed Olympics would be better than cancellation. Economically speaking, big sporting events elsewhere offer hope that the games can proceed. Just this week, America's National Football League crowned a new Super Bowl champion, while the Australian Open, an international tennis tournament, got underway, despite a series of COVID-19 scares. The Olympics, however, present a challenge on a different scale. Some 1,200 players, staff, and officials visited Australia for the Open. More than 11,000 athletes from some 200 countries are booked to compete in Tokyo, with many more officials, coaches, and reporters tagging along. Organizers must figure out how to keep athletes healthy especially in close contact sports. Outbreaks have already disrupted sumo and rugby tournaments in Japan this year. If top contenders are infected, it would threaten not only their health, but also the integrity of the competition. Organizers will also have to work out how to welcome fans, if they are allowed to attend at all. At the moment, foreign spectators are unlikely, though some local ones may be permitted, as they have been in recent months at Japanese football and baseball games. Plans released by the organizing committee this month offer hints of what such an event might look like. Those attending would be subject to constant testing and rigorous restrictions on movement. What spectators there are would be allowed to clap, but not sing or chant. Hugs and handshakes would be avoided. The Japanese government's COVID-19 tracking app, Kokoa, would be deployed to try to stop the spread of any infections. It has problems of its own. The health ministry recently admitted that for more than 4 months, a bug prevented the Android version of the app from notifying users who came into close contact with individuals who tested positive for COVID-19. The fate of the games, like so much else, will depend on how the pandemic progresses. In private, some sources close to the government presume that holding them as scheduled will prove impossible. They wonder about the next unclaimed summer slot in 2032. Other sources think the obstacles will seem less daunting once the winter outbreak ebbs and vaccines start flowing. The public, they reckon, will come around. Either way, Japan will probably twist and turn to avoid making a unilateral decision, lest it be seen as denying the world. Last year's postponement came only after Australia's and Canada, among others, announced they would not send any athletes. In late January, by contrast, the head of Australia's national committee declared, quote, "The Tokyo Games are on. The flame will be lit on July 23, 2021, unquote. If any athletes do indeed make it to the starting line, that in itself will be a feat worthy of a medal.
Iowa meat packers await vaccine. Not clear when they will receive shots after some Illinois neighbors got theirs. Filed by Tyler Jett of the Des Moines Register. While Iowa meatpacking workers don't know when they will receive COVID-19 vaccinations, their counterparts in neighboring Illinois are getting their first shots this week. Some of Iowa's largest meatpacking plants, where thousands of employees work on tightly packed processing lines, were the scene of large COVID-19 outbreaks last spring. The companies have since taken preventative measures, such as erecting barriers between workstations, but workers and labor representatives say they are still concerned about contracting the virus. JBS spokesperson Nikki Richardson confirmed to the Des Moines Register that employees at the company's Beardstone, Illinois plant received the vaccine on Friday. Mark Lauritsen, vice president of the United Food and Commercial Workers International Union, said this will be the first large-scale vaccination of meatpacking workers that he knows of. Quote, "The infrastructure and the preparedness on the union side and on the employer's side is done," Lauritsen said, when asked when Iowa workers will receive vaccinations. Quote, "Now we're just waiting on the doses," unquote. It's not clear when Iowa meatpackers will receive the inoculations. Richardson said state health officials have not provided a timeline, while spokespeople for Smithfield Foods and Tyson Foods, which, along with JBS, operate Iowa's largest meatpacking plants, declined to say whether Iowa officials have given them an answer. Illinois and Iowa are prioritizing their vaccine distribution differently. Iowa is currently offering vaccines to people 65 and older, school teachers, child care employees, and emergency responders, including police officers, firefighters, and paramedics. In Illinois, 10 different groups are eligible for the vaccine, including meatpacking workers. An Illinois Department of Public Health spokesperson said county health officials are deciding how to divide vaccines among those groups in their communities. In Iowa, a board appointed by Governor Kim Reynolds recommended in early January that the state allow meatpacking workers to receive the vaccine beginning February 1st. As in Illinois, those employees would have been among other eligible groups, including anyone 75 years or older, inmates, and prison and jail employees. But Reynolds, following the recommendation of federal officials, instead lowered the age group eligibility threshold for the vaccine to 65 from 75. She then put meatpacking workers and other groups in lower tiers. About 660,000 Iowans are among those currently eligible. The state is receiving fewer than 50,000 doses a week for people awaiting their first inoculations. At that pace, the state would not vaccinate everyone in the current group until the first week of May, though Iowa's vaccine deliveries may increase as production continues to ramp up. Spokespeople for JBS, Smithfield Foods, and Tyson Foods said their companies are prepared to administer shots at the plants when they are available. Richardson said JBS is providing a $100 incentive to any worker who gets the shot. Tyson's Foods spokesperson Liz Croston said the schedule for the company's workers to get the vaccine, quote, varies from state to state, unquote. But she added that employees in Wilkesboro, North Carolina, received shots earlier this month. The employees themselves aren't sure what to expect. Anthony Washington, who works at Tyson Foods pork processing plant in Columbus Junction, said a company nurse told him the employees will get shots in maybe in March, unquote. Though the meatpacking plants were the site of some of Iowa's largest COVID-19 outbreaks last spring and summer, it's not clear how many workers tested positive in the fall or winter. State health officials do not provide data about coronavirus cases in each plant. Lauritsen said he thinks cases have gone down because the companies spaced workers out at cafeterias and locker rooms. He also credited the companies for installing ultraviolet lights to kill viruses and bacteria in their plants' ventilation systems. During a news conference Tuesday, UFCW International President Mark Perrone did not criticize states for prioritizing older residents and frontline law enforcement employees over the union's members, but he said meat packers and grocery store workers need vaccines soon because of the presence of new strains of the virus in the United States. Quote, the threat of this pandemic for essential workers is now worse than it has ever been, Perrone said. And that does it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls, The Courier, for Monday, February 15th. I'm your reader, Bob Young. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And you may wish to stay tuned to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald, which follows shortly. Thanks so much for listening, and have a great day and stay warm.